Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
In the slowing down process and actually the handling of the plants, I really feel like it's brought me closer to the earth and what it provides and an appreciation for it. And I've seen it as a kind of healing process in many ways, like working with medicinal plants. And there's something in that process that is hard to describe that happens internally, but there's a sense of ease. And I see it as an act of non-aggression and just knowing that I'm working, you know, with the environment in an environmentally friendly way was important to me in my process.
I'm thrilled to welcome two artist mothers to the podcast today, Amanda Brazier and Danila Remold. They are going to share about their work with sustainable materials and how they create their art. They're going to share more about their process and their journey toward making their art more eco-conscious and earth-friendly. So Amanda Brazier is a painter living in Chattanooga, Tennessee. She received her BA in Studio Art and Spanish from Fried Hardeman University in 2007. And for the last 10 years, she's been gathering and using local earth pigments in her paintings in order to connect more deeply with the history and material of painting and place. She's also a facilitator for the public art organization Mark Making. And Danila Remold received her MFA in painting from the University of Washington in Seattle in 2001. She was a full-time lecturer for Seattle University, working there for 10 years before she moved to San Francisco and then on to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where she currently resides with her partner and two children. And over time, her work has shifted from formal concerns of oil painting to mixed media work that combines botanical color and natural fibers. Danila and Amanda, thank you so much for sharing in conversation with me today. I'm delighted to talk with you. Welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yes. Okay. So always like to offer just a point for you to share something about your journey so far, maybe starting with something in childhood that got you interested in art. Could you point us back to something that you feel like inspired you in your earlier years and that led you on your path to being an artist today? Amanda, why don't you start?
Yeah. So I remember in elementary school, my great aunt Phil from Indiana, she gave me a sketchbook and an art kit with like all the markers and the watercolor palette and, you know, it was like a big black folder type thing with a clasp. And I remember I carried that around everywhere and filled up sketchbook after sketchbook after sketchbook. And so I don't know what age I was. I feel like it was early elementary, and some of my like best memories are sitting by the fire in our living room and drawing and sketching. And then, of course, you know, my grandmother's my mom sewed our clothes as well. My grandfather is a gardener and a carpenter. And I remember helping my dad build things, you know, mostly by trial and error. So all of that, I think, contributed to me shaping my identity as an artist and creative person.
Awesome. I love that. You never know what gift, you know, can change somebody's life, especially when they're a kid, just putting materials in front of them. Danila, what about you? Can you point us back to something in childhood that you feel like sort of started you on this path of becoming an artist?
Yeah, sure. I guess I would say I can remember going back to childhood when I might say something to my parents like I was bored, and my dad would say, "Why don't you draw something?" So I literally did. And really, my first studio was in the basement of my childhood home growing up in Evanston, Illinois, where I really got busy working with watercolors, acrylics, and oils as well. And so I was always just busy making something on paper or canvas. And also in school, I can remember just notebooks filled with entire pages filled in with ballpoint pen drawings, these kind of all over compositional drawings that really later signified, you know, back to that. So
I love that. What do you do when you're bored? Create something, right?
Right.
I often find myself telling my kids the same thing, like, no screen. You can put something out into the world that's beautiful. Spend some time creating, right? Okay, Amanda, back to you. Why don't you describe your work for somebody who may not have yet seen it before this podcast coming out? You know, just interested to hear you talk a little bit about, you know, what your work looks like visually. We're going to spend a lot of time talking about your process and the materials, yeah. But if you could talk just a little bit about what it looks like in your palette and some of the like formal qualities of the work.
Okay, sure. Yeah, so I primarily work in painting. For a long time, it's been oil on panel. Since having kids, and this might be a question that comes up later, but mm-hmm. I've transitioned a bit into watercolor on paper. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of work between those two mediums. And of course, I paint with earth pigments. And so that's my palette, is those the golden yellows and the red orange, soft blue, gray greens, dusty purples, deep rose, mm-hmm. browns. So just very earthy, and I have no idea how to paint with anything else now, you know? but I guess formally, I like to think I build the surface of my paintings in a similar way to someone building a home, like a log cabin or an early woven wattle and daub dwelling, or even like someone weaving a cloth. So combining those rigid and soft coverings, those things that protect us in comforting soft ways and also in like stronger, more protective ways. So a lot of my lines are repeating, they're stacked. It's very repetitive over under patterns. Mm-hmm. And I usually kind of say it's geometric abstraction, but it's also lived in. So I want it to be imperfect and not too rigid and somehow permeable, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then I guess recently I've been doing some other series of work that break from that just a little bit. So some recent watercolors are more kind of symbolic of place. I've been sitting in a certain place in my hometown, my town of Chattanooga, and, you know, painting, you know, maybe some architectural qualities of the bridge or things like that. So it's a little bit more representational and kind of symbolic, like a clumsy beginning of a language, you know, like I'm learning a new language. So that's generally my work.
Thank you. I love that. Danila, what about you? Can you describe what your work looks like and talk a little bit about its formal qualities?
Sure. Yeah. My work is minimal. It's rooted in formal elements of line, shape, texture, and color. My palette is earthy and extracted from botanical colors. So similarly, shades of desert tones, dusty pinks, soft yellows, greens, and browns. I work exclusively with natural fibers such as Kozo paper made of mulberry, cotton paper such as Fabriano and Reeves BFK, and I work with some fabrics such as silk, wool, and cotton. I process and stain my materials by dyeing them in hot and cold dye baths. And then I often, after they've been dyed, I will process them further by exposing them to different domestic household tools such as washing machines, irons, stovetop burners, just to kind of give them a processing through a domestic methods and mark making. And then finally, sort of once I process all my materials, I decide whether the piece should become a collage, a drawing, a painting, or an installation. And similarly to Amanda, I feel like in that process, it's very constructed, mm-hmm. Almost thinking about it like a construction site where I'm layering, cutting, tearing, and sort of building up the surface.
Thank you. I love how both of your palettes just really complement each other. I mean, I'm sure that's something that'll come up when we talk a little bit more about like natural materials is the specific palette, but certainly fun to think about the ways that your work works together and speaks together because of the materials you use. So before we really dive in and talking about, you know, this sustainable methodology and processing. I want to hear just a little bit more about who you are, like as a person, as a mother, maybe what else do you do outside of, you know, your art career, and talk a little bit more about like how many kids you have and their ages. Danila, can you start for me?
Sure. Yeah. Let's see. I have two children. They're 5 and 7. And I guess outside of parenting and sort of the domestic labor and the art practice, things that I like to do are yoga, going out and hiking in nature, collecting plants, looking at them, identifying them. And I also have a meditation practice that I try and get to when I can steal some quiet moments.
Harder in the pandemic, right?
Always hard. Hard in parenting and even harder in the pandemic. But even more necessary.
Yes, absolutely. Amanda, what about you?
Yeah, well, I have two sons similar in age to Danila's. Mine are 6 and 3.
Okay.
And my 6-year-old just started in-person kindergarten this semester.
Nice.
So that's been, it's this week. So today is his virtual day. Anyways, but so two boys, they are currently being babysat by Toy Story upstairs. So I work in my basement studio at home. So my husband is not home yet. So they're just, you know, Buzz and Woody all the way.
Nice.
And yeah, so in addition to my painting practice, I'm also a runner, and specifically a trail runner. And I mean, that has waned in the past 5 years.
Yeah.
Since becoming a mom, and I got injured during a race, but that's something I love to do. And also I love to garden.
Mm.
And I am also, like my dad, trial and erroring it. And so, yeah. And so that's a couple of things that I like to do. Reading and, you know, of course, spiritual practices and things like that too.
Great. Thank you so much for sharing. Okay. Let's dive into just talking about natural materials. I want to go back to sort of the inspiration for both of you, like where, you know, has your art journey always coincided with this idea of like wanting materials to be sustainable that you're working with, or kind of like what was the, you know, sort of the fork in the road where you really like switched to, or at least I imagine that it wasn't always built on a sustainable set of materials, but maybe it was. And if it wasn't, kind of what was the place where you really decided to switch and look into, you know, getting rid of the more toxic materials and integrating natural materials into your practice? Amanda, can you start for me?
Sure. Yeah. So I started working with earth pigment specifically in 2011. So right at 10 years ago. And that year was a really difficult year for me and my family. My parents had gotten divorced. A tornado had come through Chattanooga and damaged our home that we were renting. And then of course, like with my art practice, there are just lots of dead ends, and I did poorly at a couple of shows. So it was just a very difficult year. And I feel like I didn't really know where to go with my art practice. I had graduated from college a few years before. I was working mostly in isolation, and I am someone that is very difficult for me to reach out and say, help me, or be a part of a community with me. You know, I don't like to ask for help. And so, I was making art on this island, you know, and not liking what I was making and not connecting with it. And I remember painting a painting in my studio, and I thought, why am I using this acidic green right now? What colors am I supposed to use? And of course, we had, you know, color theory in college and learned about that mostly. But I just, when I was painting, my colors felt arbitrary. And do they need to be symbolic? Or how do you even make the decision on what colors to use? And I felt like maybe I was weighed down by too many options. And so I decided to, in order to move forward with my work that year, I needed to move backwards and learn about just the history of my painting, of my painting practice. in the context of the history of painting, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. So really, it also came from just a historical, I need to learn about what I'm doing. I need to learn about my materials. Mm. At the same time, I was getting more into reading about environmentalism and, you know, natural materials. So those kind of coincided. And of course, you know, the earliest pigments that humans have used are, you know, iron oxide pigments, ochres. And so that kind of led me to working with more natural pigments. Mm-hmm. And then also through the years working with pigments and kind of entering into that world opens up so many other layers of meaning within the work and within culture. So
Love that. And so you've been working, so you kind of started that journey about 10 years ago.
About 10 years ago.
10 years ago. Okay. Danila, what about you? What was kind of the intersection for you with really wanting to, you know, tweak your materials and make them more sustainable?
Yeah, thanks. I would say the intersection was really 5 years ago when I moved from San Francisco to Albuquerque. And although I had previously been painting still for, you know, the past previous 20 years in oil paint, using, you know, solvents, but during pregnancy, I became a lot more aware of that and started to eliminate turpentine and just use oils to clean my brushes and such. When I moved here and built the studio that I have, it didn't have a sink for washing and cleaning up. It really didn't have good ventilation. Mm-hmm. And my kids were little. I had a baby and a toddler, and I really was determined to continue making art, but I had to find safe ways to make it. And so that was really when it all shifted to natural materials. But that process began in my kitchen, really, when I started to observe the staining of foods that I was using to make smoothies. So things like blueberries, raspberries, beets. And I started to really take that discovery and experiment with it on paper and bringing paper into my kitchen and working on top of it. And then, you know, beginning to explore more dyeing it, making dye baths. And once I got really invested in that process and being able to incorporate my kids into the process as well at the time, I finally, after a year of doing that, made a real deep dive and commitment into natural botanical colors by taking on more the scientific end to research light fastness and learn which pigments and different methods worked best in creating light fast botanical colors.
Hmm. So interesting. I love that. Like, you know, just this was really rooted in your artist mother identity. This, because, you know, just thinking of you like in the kitchen and saying like, I need to figure out a way to still make art, but you know, this overlap of motherhood is like really shaping, you know, the physical space that you have, the time that you have, and then also influencing like the materials that you have to work with. And yeah, I love that connection there for you. Okay. So I of course have like thought through this many times, wanting to make my practice more sustainable. I'm sure many people have. Like, how could you not think that, right? But I think for me, it's like the overwhelm of the lack of knowledge, and like feeling like so overwhelmed with like research and like how do you even begin? So I want to have you talk through that like beginning phase where you really kind of, you made the decision, like, I'm going to start this practice, switch gears a little bit and move forward with something more sustainable. What were the first steps for you? Like, how did you, you know, you talked about like researching, the botanical, pigments and stuff, Danila, but like, what did that look like? How did you, like, what was the kind of the first stages of like trial and error and like moving through this process? Maybe you can start, Danila.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So once I really made that commitment to natural colors and botanical dyes, I did a couple of things. This was about a year ago now, before the pandemic started. I set myself up with an artist residency at my son's preschool, where I was working in a space there where I'd be exchanging the space to work with the kids. And I knew that the dyes would be safe and non-toxic. And so it was partially like creating an environment and a time commitment to this kind of research. And a couple of things that I did to help me along that was I simply researched some books. So living in the Southwest, I have the privilege and benefit of really having the wisdom and knowledge of Native American Pueblo people mm-hmm. and their long, long tradition of it. So I wanted to learn more about that history. So I got a couple books on Pueblo plants, and they're very botanical, scientific books. But it was a way to begin looking at what plants traditionally had been used, learning about what was light, fast, and what was not. And then I also just
Danila, what do you mean by light fast?
Oh, sorry. Light fast is meaning it won't fade. So okay. With pigments, yeah. So that they don't fade with the light. A lot of plant colors do fade. Another term that I haven't used yet, but that is important with it, would be wash fastness, so that they don't wash out of the paper or the fabrics that you're using.
Okay.
So it's really about sustainability of color. Then I just began to, I got another book on just practical handbook, really, on botanical dyes and which pigments and different recipes, really, essentially, because there's mordants that you can use. Those are additives that create both light fastness and basically help the dye, the pigment, to adhere to whatever fabric you're fusing it with. And so there's different kinds of mordants that you can use, and different mordants will shift colors. So you can shift a color from like blue to blue violet to red violet. So learning about all those different techniques of color and color changing, as well as fabrics, different fabrics absorb different colors differently. So I just became familiar, and I just took it step by step. I actually went sort of in color order. So I began with yellow, which is the most abundant color in nature, and just started to actually collect some local plants. It was in the fall, so rabbit brush or chamisa was blooming abundantly. So I went out and collected it and experimented with that. And some other local plants. And then I also began to order some that weren't regional to, like, you can get dried goods or dried dyes and then add them to water and warden. So I started to experiment more deeply with that. And just expanding my color, seeing what I could get out of the process. And honestly, sometimes like just going to a YouTube video was helpful, because there's a lot out there and you just kind of get a, there's so many different various techniques and ways to do things. So I guess like underneath all of that, like research is really just this spirit of play and experimentation and just kind of seeing what I can get, because that's one of the beauties of natural dyes, is that there's so much variety and it's difficult to even get something consistent. And so just allowing my process to flow with that was important.
I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that, Danila. I have a lot of questions, but I saw Amanda nodding her head vigorously about just, I'm sure, this shared experience. So Amanda, could you share a little bit about that part of your journey, kind of what you did initially to start learning and what were kind of some of the first steps you took?
Yeah, I was nodding at Danila talking about play, and I think that's just so important.
Yeah.
You know, just it's not a rigid structural, like, you know, black and white, this is how you're supposed to do this, because there's so many cultural traditions who have this ingredient or that ingredient, or they do this way, mm-hmm. you know, and I think play and experimentations is really important. Yeah. So the first thing I did 10 years ago was I actually took a class at the John C. Campbell Folk School. It's in Western North Carolina, in Brasstown, North Carolina, Cherokee County. And so the artist Sandy Webster was the teacher of that class, and it was called Pigments from the Earth. And so we went out and gathered different colored pigments from beside Lake Chattoog or by the subway parking lot or, you know, from a construction site. So Sandy was an amazing teacher, is an amazing teacher. And so she was really the first person I knew of, like first, I guess, contemporary artist, you know, that was close to me, close enough to go take a class from, you know, and And so I took that class. And before the class, I had kind of been experimenting with making my own paint. I had ordered a kit and, you know, I'd gotten some historical pigments and I had gotten linseed oil. But as far as like going out and knowing where even to look to find earth pigments, you know, what am I looking for? And so that was a really helpful aspect of just, I need a guide, someone to step in and say, hey, this is how you do this, you know? And so that was really wonderful to take that class with Sandy. And so then when I came home, of course, I didn't just throw all my oil paints out and say, all right, I'm just going to only 100% gather earth pigments right now. You know, it was a process of, okay, so in my yard, as I'm digging up, you know, the garden, tilling the garden to plant broccoli, what's there? And so there's a lot of red clay. And so Red Bank Red, I live in Red Bank. It's just right outside of Chattanooga. So Red Bank Red was the name of the, of that pigment, you know? And so I named my pigments by location and just the color. And I thought, okay, well, there's red. I have no idea where to look for anything else. You know, I know there's red clay. So what else is there? And I know that the Appalachian region is very rich in iron oxides in a lot of different colors. And so I just kept my eyes open, honestly. And little bit by little bit, if I was running, I'd keep my eyes on the side of the trail and ask for permission there before gathering. Or driving somewhere, I kept my eyes, you know, on the side of the road. And one of my favorite spots to gather actually is on the side of the interstate. So it's really hard to see color when you're driving at 70 miles an hour. But I drove this stretch of Interstate 24 to Nashville. My family lives in Nashville, so I grew up there. But from Chattanooga to Nashville, Interstate 24, I just kept seeing this streak of red in the rock exposure. And so finally, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, it was fairly recently, I stopped on the side of the interstate, you know, put my emergency lights on and gathered, you know, and it was like great, like crazy, like these big 18 wheelers driving by. And I'm like, I'm trying to be like quiet and meditative, you know, and anyway,
connecting with the earth,
connecting here, you know, but I think that was like a beautiful, combination of speed and stillness. And anyways, yeah, so it was just little bit by little bit what I can discover or what presents itself to me and how I can learn it. Of course, like Danila, I got different books on how to make paint or how to make other mediums from colors from the earth. You know, we have, and I guess I could email you a list, Kaylin, for later, but Colors from the Earth by Ann Wall Thomas. Sandy Webster wrote a book, Earth and Pigments, and that and that came out after I took a class with her. And then, of course, The Organic Artist by Nick Netto is also a really great resource. So those are three. And my friend Lauren Souter just came out with a book as well, A Geology of Color. Anyways, there's a lot of resources out there that I didn't realize 10 years ago. And I think a lot of them are newer. And some of the books are also out of print. Like Colors from the Earth is out of print. But I think just reading, reaching out to people who have been there and keeping your eyes open. You know, those were all really important things to start.
Love that. Yeah. Do you feel like, or did you feel like at the time when you started that there were a lot of artists already working with sustainable materials, or was it kind of like, do you feel like it's becoming more accessible, this knowledge?
Yeah. When I started, I had no idea.
Yeah.
You know, I don't even know when Instagram was invented, but I feel like I have
like
no idea.
12 years
maybe
ago?
Maybe 12. Maybe. And I was like, it took me a long time to even get on Instagram, maybe 5 years ago. And so I feel like I didn't know anyone in Tennessee. I knew Sandy, but I don't know that, you know, I felt like I was kind of doing this on my own. And, and I'm sure it was a growing thing, you know, a growing practice among many people. But to me, maybe it was just me being oblivious.
Yeah. I mean, I think like in terms of, and my question was for like contemporary artists who are like working with these materials. I think obviously there's like a long history of Indigenous people that have like worked with sustainable materials and made art. And but yeah, like I was more referencing like contemporary artists that you know or within your community. What about you, Danila? Do you feel like you had a lot of artists that you knew who were kind of on this path, or is it more, do you feel like that now, or do you feel like it's kind of just you and a few others?
Yeah, no, I think that's an interesting question, because I don't have any other artists that I personally know who are working with sustainable materials, although I'm hearing more about it, particularly during the pandemic, where I think a lot of supplies quickly ran out and things weren't as accessible. And as we kind of process how things move forward, what is going to be available or not anymore, and thinking about ways of, you know, when we're slowing down and thinking about perhaps more self-sustainability, that I think artists are thinking about that more. Also in terms of environmental impact and where are these, you know, toxic materials going and how does it affect the land and particularly the water. And so I do think it is becoming greater sort of global consciousness with artists. But I didn't have any immediate artists in my world that I knew working with it.
And I will add, Kaylin, right now there is a huge movement of people who are working in sustainable materials, natural pigments and dyes. And back when I first started, I didn't know, but now as, you know, as things have progressed and people have learned more and the world has kind of opened up with social media, I feel like it's been easier to connect with those. Oh, you live in Vancouver, you live in, you know, Scotland, you know, and we can kind of connect more with people who are doing similar things. And so, you know, there's the Wild Pigment Project, founded by Tilka Elkins, wonderful human being. And so she's done so much to connect fellow color lovers, you know, and of course, Heidi Gustafson, and just so many others who are very, it's a very open and it's a very, I guess it's a very friendly, wonderful group of people. Like we are doing this together, and it's very open-hearted.
I like hearing that.
Great community.
Okay, tell me a little bit more about the actual process of working with these materials. Maybe let's start with like what's been the biggest learning curve, like coming from more traditional, like commercial materials, and moving towards natural. Like what are the things that at least initially were kind of the hardest to work around? Amanda, can you start?
Sure. Yeah. I guess for me was, where am I supposed to look for color?
And by color, you mean actual sourced material to make paint.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. So my color comes from clay. It comes from rocks like shale. Or some kind of limestone shale. There's like, you know, there's a spectrum. And, so when I look for colors, I'm looking for colored rocks or colored soils. So once I kept my eyes open and I started seeing color everywhere all around me, I gather some. Really paint making is fairly simple. I definitely think that as compared to dyeing, natural dyeing, paint making is simply a pigment, whatever that is, you know, and linseed oil, or that's oil paint. So a pigment and a binder. And so, but I guess for me, part of the difficulty was, how does this pigment work in linseed oil? You know, and how much oil to add to this pigment. It seems like it's really gritty, or it seems like the pigment particles are sticking together, you know? So like, this doesn't seem like it really likes this kind of linseed oil. Maybe I might try kind of maybe a different kind of linseed oil. And then that goes the same in watercolor as well. So how do these pigment particles, this specific pigment as opposed to that pigment, how do they interact with the binder? So that was a learning curve. But again, it is very simple to start, you know, and really all you need is pigment and water, you know, or pigment and egg yolk. Like it is a very simple process, but yeah, it's just kind of learning your medium again and what works. Mm-hmm.
Danila, what about you? What do you feel like was your biggest? And you're more dye-based rather than paint-based, right?
I was thinking about listening to Amanda. One interesting thing is like what you see is not necessarily what you get with plants. Like on the outside, everything's green or yellow, but green's actually the hardest color to extract. You have to actually do an overlay process for green. And so one of the first challenges was trying to just get the components right of water to dye and how much you need the ratio to get the color out of the plant and create a dye. And the second part was getting color saturation. So I'm kind of still thinking like a painter, like how bright is the color, and then also expanding the color palette. Like I had mentioned earlier, yellow is the most abundant color to get, but getting some of these other colors like blue and green can be a lot more challenging. And so really trying to discover which, plants will give you the colors that you're looking for in the color spectrum, as well as what I mentioned earlier, the overlay. So like when you're dyeing, you might take, let's say blue and indigo and then dye something with it. And then you dye it again in a yellow to create green. So like weld, for example, might be a plant you could use. So learning how to overlay is sort of been the next level of my process of learning how to work with plant dyes.
And Danila, everything that you dye, are you sourcing yourself, or is that just like an extra layer to the process that you enjoy doing sometimes? Can you just buy natural dye and then it's just in the way you would buy paint?
Almost, yeah. I mean, so I collect what I can when it's either seasonal or what's regional. And then, but I also do buy, like I mentioned earlier, sort of raw materials. So you can buy it raw, like the roots or the shells of things, even cochineal bugs, you can get them dried out, even though I can collect those here off of the cactus plants. So you can buy a lot of what you need if you can't get it. And sometimes the color saturation can be a lot brighter because it's more intensely pigmented when it's ground down into its sort of dry matter, I suppose, than a plant. And also whether you use a plant, fresh or not, will vary the color saturation. So there's just so many variables. But to answer your question, yeah, you can. I do buy much of my materials that I use to dye, but I also collect what I can.
Yeah, I'm just thinking like if somebody like that, the sourcing might be something that could hold people back, I feel like, because they're like, I'm not interested in this whole process of like going out and gathering things. Maybe they don't know where they would gather it. Like maybe they live in a city and it's like, going to a public park feels kind of weird to just like cut stuff down. And like I feel like even for me, like investigating that, it's like, where would I source things? And of course, like I don't want to feel limited in like the palette and, just like, so if you live in, Tennessee and you can't find blue and green materials or whatever, like just thinking through that. But like knowing that there are actually places where you can just buy ready to go natural materials, I think is really important. Cause like, I didn't even really know that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I was just going to mention, you had said about urban, like collecting, there is this great book by Jason Logan on Make Ink. And, it's a forager's guide to natural ink making. And a lot of the materials, I think he lives in New York, a lot of the materials are found in the city. So wherever you are, there are things that can be collected, whether you live rurally or in an urban center. So that's just something extra to kind of keep in mind, depending on if someone is interested in getting into this, that there are options out there. You just have to find what's available. So...
I'm delighted to share that this episode of the Artist Mother Podcast is sponsored by an artist mother and tax expert, Hannah Cole of Sunlight Tax. Is your creative practice gaining steam? Maybe you just got a big grant or a big show. You're excited to get to work, but a nagging feeling tells you that there are some tax issues that could hurt you. What you don't know might actually be holding you back from all that you can accomplish. You just want to get down to the studio and do the work you love, but finances and tax concerns are dragging you down. Thankfully, Sunlight Tax is here for you. Artist and tax pro Hannah Cole started Sunlight Tax to empower creative people with the tax and money tools you need so you can have more money, more time, and make a bigger impact with your work. Who doesn't want that? Sunlight Tax offers an annual membership called Money Bootcamp, which is tailored to your busy creative life to teach you targeted skills for your financial health and taxes. Hannah guides you through the pitfalls into simple systems so you can stay on track, start investing in yourself, and get back to the studio without getting bogged down. Right now, listeners of the Artist Mother podcast can get a free artist tax deduction guide by going to sunlighttax.com/artistmother. That's sunlighttax.com/artistmother. Thank you, Hannah, for providing so much to artists and helping us through with all of our financial concerns. It's so reassuring to have experts like you we can trust and we know are looking out for us. Head to sunlighttax.com to find out more about everything Hannah has to offer, and don't forget your free artist tax deduction guide just for our community at sunlighttax.com/artistmother.
Okay, so you both kind of talked about the initial learning curve. Like, now that you're more familiar with the materials, and you've been working with them a while, what do you feel like are still the drawbacks to working with natural materials? And I don't mean drawbacks like of course I know, like, ethically they're, like, I'm not talking about like ethical drawbacks or anything like that. Like, I know if you are someone who values, you know, sustainability, like, this is something that we should be thinking about. But just in terms of materiality, like, I'm sure you can't deny that there are some, you know, things that you just can't really do working with natural materials that you can if you're working with acrylic paint, for example, that's basically plastic, you know? So just interested to hear you talk about, like, maybe some of the challenges that have come up in terms of something you wanted to make, but you just are struggling getting there with the materials. And of course, that can happen no matter what material you're using, right? Like, you have this idea in your head and you're like, I just can't execute it in the way that I want. But just knowing that you've had this history of working with non-natural materials, I'm just interested to hear you talk through some of the drawbacks. And then, of course, we'll talk about the great things that you found and the rewards kind of after that. Daniela, you want to start?
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I always have to come back to the lightfastness of it, just like that I'm limited to, at this point, I am committed to making my work be, you know, sustainable. Also, to, if somebody wanted to collect it, that it's not going to fade on them. Mm-hmm. So I'm more concerned about that. So I'm limited in terms of the kinds of colors that I can use. And I think, you know, that's the major thing. I guess another concern I have is the amount of water that it uses. Although I know that I've been beginning to source rain from my rain barrels. It doesn't rain a ton here in the desert. It's been a long time this year since we've had a good rainfall. But when it does fill up, I try and use that rainwater. So it's just something I'm aware of, the amount of water that it uses in terms of sustainability is maybe one of the drawbacks of working with natural dyes. And the third thing I would say is just getting, like, since I am a painter, and I just have that love for paint and the ooze of it and the materiality, it's such a viscous, dyes are viscous and they soak into whatever you are, paper or canvas. And so Amanda is inspiring me to move into beginning to make my own mineral paints as well, because I think the next step for me is to begin to make those and paint on top of dyed fabrics and paper. So I guess at this point in time, that has felt like a limitation, but I also know that I just have to kind of expand my practice now. Mm-hmm. So
what about you, Amanda?
Yeah, I would say one of the biggest drawbacks, especially if you're going to go out and gather your own materials, is the time it takes. it is a very slow process, you know, and us natural pigment people, we're committed to the slowness of it. Mm-hmm. And that's in stark contrast to, you know, our culture at large. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's countercultural kind of thing, you know, which I love, but it's also like, it takes time. And so we're mothers and we don't have a lot of time. Mm-hmm. And so just like being able to like spend the time, you know, out in the field, I'll take my boys with me, mm-hmm. you know, and they love that. They love that. It's so much fun. I'm not going to let them out of the car on the side of the interstate, but we can go, you know, different places and gather. And my older son, Judah, is always finding any sort of rock. Like he's just, Mommy, this is great. And I'm like, oh, that's like a piece of like really hard limestone that has no color in it. Right. Thank you. but yeah, just the slowness and the tedium. And that's like also a lot of motherhood. Mm-hmm. The slow of making of I'm pounding these rocks. I'm sifting this pigment. I'm making this paint when I could have gone to the art store and bought something, mm-hmm. you know. Or I could have ordered the actual pigment in powdered form from Natural Pigments Company, mm-hmm. you know, and that would have been a lot easier. But I think the narrative is very important to a lot of our work. So that the slowness. Also, if I run out of paint in the middle of getting ready for an art show or doing a commission, you know, like, okay, you know, I got to make some more. And that's like another day or two or even a week. Mm-hmm. And if I'm not like thinking ahead and already have paint made, you know, right. Which I don't always think ahead. I'm not great at that. So yeah, just kind of having that timeline down. And then also each pigment behaves differently, like I said, with making. It also behaves differently drying. Mm-hmm. And so maybe this reddish iron oxide ochre dries quickly, but then maybe the yellow does not, mm-hmm. you know? And so it's just, you're just dealing with, I want to move on to this next part of the painting, but this yellow is still wet, you know? And whereas in modern pigments, in their formulas, they'll balance everything out mm-hmm. to where everything dries more or less uniformly, you know? So you're just dealing with different personalities.
That makes sense. Okay, let's talk about the rewards. Like, what are some of the, I don't know, just the best things that you've felt and learned? What are some of the things that you've been surprised by on this journey towards, you know, using sustainable materials, Danila?
Yeah, I just really wanted to jump in here because I think my reward is possibly, Amanda, one of her drawbacks on the slowness, because with plant dyeing, one of the beautiful things about it is that because it requires so much time, like it's done over times, also it could be hours, it could be days, I can allow it to take that time because I can, you know, bring it to a certain boiling point, bring it down to simmer and walk away and go parent or do something else, cook a meal. But it's still like processing in
like
in
crock pot cooking.
It is. It's amazing.
crock pot painting.
I think about it that way. Yeah. It's just like it kind of does it on its own. Mm. I just have to do a few things and it's magic is happening while I'm away. So I really love that. And it helps me keep up sort of with that, the busy domestic life on in that sense while processing my materials. And sometimes just leaving it, you know, overnight for sure, but a day or two can enhance the color saturation, or you get some surprising modulation on the fabric that occurred by being scrunched up in the pot for so long. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I'll dye things in bins, like I'll pour it out so it's flat. So there's different ways that I dye it, but I can often just leave it and walk away. So for me, that's been a real reward in the process. And the other thing I feel like is a reward is it in the slowing down process and actually the handling of the plants, I really feel like it's brought me closer to the earth and what it provides and an appreciation for it. And I've seen it as a kind of healing process in many ways, like working with medicinal plants. And there's something in that process that is hard to describe that happens internally, but there's a sense of ease. And I see it as an act of non-aggression and just knowing that I'm working, you know, with the environment mm-hmm. in an environmentally friendly way, is important to me in my process.
That's beautiful, Daniela. Thanks for sharing. Amanda, what about you? What do you feel like are some of the rewards that you've experienced from making your practice more sustainable?
Oh, there are so many. There are so many. So working with the land here is helping me to learn to be quiet and to listen and to learn about the land, the people who were here before us. And in that case, that's the Cherokee in southeastern Tennessee, Georgia, North Carolina. So it's kind of pushing me to branch out and to learn more about where I am, how can I help take care of where I am, and how can I even, you know, uplift those who were, you know, brutally forced out of here, you know, and how can I, and this is me, like, I am at a very beginning process of that. And I have sent some emails to some indigenous art and culture groups. So we'll see where that leads. But just kind of like, it's pushing me to get out of, you know, I'm in the studio, I'm doing this for myself. I'm not doing this for myself. You know, I mean, this is learning and also teaching and listening to the land better and listening to the land keepers. Also, I do like the quietness, the slowness. The rocks can be my friends and my teachers, you know, and so every color, you know, I even like talk to them, you know, and I'm sure Daniela talks to her plants. I mean, it's just like, it's just part of the process, you know, like, hey, you're just so beautiful. And how are you doing today? And anyways, so they're companions and they're my teachers. And I'm not really alone. The rocks are living beings in their own way. And then also just the restriction of working with this specific palette is really a freedom, you know? And I remember, and we all had, you know, in art school or in high school when we took art classes or whenever, like we had these projects where it was, hey, you have this, this, and this, make something with it, you know? And I always did better when we had those kinds of projects rather than, okay, Amanda, do whatever you want, you know, like there's like too many options, you know? And like I was talking about at the beginning of our conversation, when I had like too many options, like there's too many colors to choose from, I don't know what to do. It's difficult. It kind of paralyzes me a bit. And so having those restricted options, putting those boundaries up and saying, this is it for me, it opens up a whole new world of, you know, there's freedom of choice within these boundaries. And actually, I wanted to share a quote with you guys, a book that I read recently on trails by Robert Moore. He talked about the freedom of the trail. And he said, the freedom of the trail is riverine, like a river, not oceanic. So there's a path that you are following that some choices have already been made, and you can continue on that path and still make beautiful things and still move and still create in a way that's meaningful. So
beautiful, Amanda. Thank you so much. Let's talk a little bit about how your studio spaces have changed, both just, you know, as your career has moved forward, but also I'm just thinking, like, again, as you collect and start utilizing natural materials, like, what are some of the things that you need that maybe a more traditional artist wouldn't need, like access to kitchens and stoves and tubs for pouring, you know, dye? And like, I'm just trying to think logistically through some of the things that have sort of shifted for you in your practice, Daniela.
Yeah, it's fairly simple, really, in my case. I mean, I did begin in the kitchen, But as I started to learn more about it, you know, I read up on suggestions of keeping, you know, like your kitchen pots and pans and spoons separate from your dye one. So I went out and bought, you know, special tools for just dyeing, which I now keep in my studio. And I also just bought a very simple single burner that I use to, you know, heat my water and my plants to do the dye baths. So those are really like the two main things that I now need that I previously didn't have.
Do you have water access in your studio?
I don't in my studio, but I have just outside. My studio is in the front of our house, mm-hmm. where there's also a hose attachment. So I have access to water right outside my door.
Okay. And so, you're in like a great climate for, you know, working year round, indoor, outdoor, yeah. kind of sustainable materials too.
Absolutely. Yes. And I'm trying to think, there's not really too much else. I have the rain barrel out there too. If I can use it, if I can't, I'll use the faucet. So, mm-hmm.
Amanda, what about you? Do you feel like there's any specific studio needs that you have to have with, you know, your practice right now, or like how have you kind of adapted your studio to fit this better, this material process better?
Well, I have a large collection of mason jars that I keep a lot of colors in. We're on a video here. You can kind of see like all the shelves with mason jars. So anyways, that's helpful. And also I do have tools that I use for paint making. But as far as like the structure of my studio, it's a pretty traditional painting studio. I just need to have a big table to spread pigments out on. And when I'm doing my paint making, I'll have a big glass slab that's frosted, and, you know, just different special paint making tools, a mortar and pestle and things like that. But also when I'm teaching pigment workshops, I also say there are some things you don't really have to buy just yet if you just want to experiment, you know? Mm-hmm. And so you can find a flat rock in your yard and a rock that you can hold in your hand if you want to practice, you know, pounding pigments that way. You do not have to buy a mortar and pestle just yet, mm-hmm. you know, and you can experiment with like the bottom of a glass for a muller, you know, on a plate that you don't really need. So it's just using those basic materials. If someone's thinking about, oh, I'd like to make paint, you know, it can be something very simple, but yeah. And I also teach workshops. So I'm like amassing this, you know, like this collection of mortar and pestles and big pieces of glass and mm-hmm. glass mullers and things like that and sieves. So yeah, but other than that, pretty traditional painting studio.
Okay. All right. What about some ways you think about sustainability in other areas of your life? Like, do you feel like this, like, which came first, the chicken or the egg, you know, kind of like did your interest in sustainability in other areas of your life sort of influence this part of your practice? Or do you feel like going on this journey within your art studio kind of has influenced the rest of your life? Like, interested to hear how that has played out, Amanda.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mentioned before that kind of I started down this road of like reading more about, you know, stewardship and taking care of the earth about the same time that I started working with earth pigments. And they have gone hand in hand, you know. And actually, I was talking with our mutual friend, Lisa Parsons, and we were talking about how just because you use natural pigments in your work doesn't mean that you have, like, you know, you've checked the box of mm-hmm. sustainability, you know. And so it does extend beyond dyeing with natural materials and, you know, working with earth pigments. And so, yeah, just, I guess, in my life and in my studio practice, you know, like, use what you have instead of buying something brand new. Mm-hmm. So look around your studio. What can you use? Don't just throw things away just because, you know, you think the usefulness is done. So how can you look at the things you have in new ways? And that also goes for the home. And so that also extends to taking care of our materials, mm-hmm. which, you know, keep your paint brushes in good condition, you know, and just extend the life of your materials in some way. And that also goes to, and I know I'm combining the two, my painting practice and my home life, but oh, it's, it's so intermingled, you know? Yep. So yeah, so taking care of what we already have, mending your clothes, you know, and buying better quality things, or, of course, buying used as well. So anyway, so all of that, let's see, as far as like, well, and this is my life and studio together, and I know I'm probably rambling, but borrow instead of buying something new, buy used and source new responsibly, you know, and if you're concerned about this product or that product, call the company, mail. And yeah, so then in my life itself, I'm trying to be part of like the zero waste movement. Mm-hmm. But of course we all need to give each other grace in that, because, you know, zero is probably a misnomer. Mm-hmm. It's as close as you can get, right? And so just kind of taking part of that composting, and I just installed the Nila My Rain barrel that's been sitting in my basement for probably 10 years. You know, I went to this Master Gardener's workshop and like built it, but I never installed it in my house. And so, you know, COVID, we were quarantining and I had some extra time. You know what? I'm going to install that rain barrel. And it's been wonderful. So, and we got a lot of rain. And anyways, yeah, just those kind of lifestyle choices, less plastic, and reducing meat intake, and all of those things. Mm-hmm. So.
Thanks, Amanda. Danila, what about you? How do you think about sustainability in your own life and sort of how your art practice maybe has influenced that, or maybe your call to sustainability sort of influenced your art practice?
Yeah, thanks. I love this question. I think it goes kind of both ways. I, for a long time, have been thinking about how to, you know, make things more sustainable, reducing household waste. Or in the studio, as artists, we use a lot of materials, paper, canvas, things that get thrown away, or just using a lot of them. And I never really quite felt like I was actively making steps towards that. And so now that I've really begun on this journey, I feel like it's influencing both my life and my art more directly in the following ways. One, it does also begin in the household. So when I first began working with natural materials, even before dyeing, I was sourcing materials from the kitchen as well, like cardboard boxes, eggshells, and other materials, onion skins, and using them in my art. But as I narrowed in on my materials and really sort of focused in on just the dyes and the natural fibers part, I started to transfer that effort of reducing waste and reusing just really to the home, the household. And while I was working in that residency that I had started in my son's preschool before COVID, one of the other mothers that came to the studio once a week to work with me, Rachel Zulevi, and she runs the Zero Waste New Mexico group, she was collecting old white t-shirts from the thrift stores and cutting them and sewing them into bags, and I was dyeing them. And so it really, her whole lifestyle was super inspiring to me in terms of, like, I think she throws out her garbage seriously like twice a year.
Oh my gosh, inspiring.
It's mind blowing. It's such hard work and it takes so much dedication, but she really, just that time working with her on that project really made me think about things like buying bulk foods and not buying foods that are wrapped in packaging, using my own bags, of course, and, you know, not taking bags from the store. So just trying to reduce the amount of waste I bring in and put out of our household. And that is definitely a work in progress, let me just say.
Yeah.
So, but it's something I'm aware of and working on. The other places, sustainability also within clothing. Amanda had mentioned that. So I'm trying to purchase fewer clothing items. And if I'm buying, you know, new, buying it from a company that's making sustainable products that will last longer. And then also, or shopping consignment, and then really starting to experiment with dyeing my own clothing, or dyeing white clothings that get stains on them. And so I'm really looking into maybe starting to match my artwork more in terms of the color palette and dyeing them myself.
like Mindy Wittick talking about having an outfit that matches that you wear to your opening night.
I think I'm going to do that same route. So, but with botanical colors, desert tone. And then, the third way is a little bit different beyond materiality, but like materials, I guess, and things that we produce and create waste with, but it's sustainability in art life, where I'm starting to prioritize wellness. Mm. So my wellness, mental, physical, and financial. So sort of looking at like how much in the past have I put into my work, career, life, and kind of sacrificed in terms of those areas of wellness. Mm-hmm. So I'm prioritizing that over striving, stress, and sort of external validation to how do I feel and how can I move forward from here in a way that makes my practice sustainable. Mm. And I'm really lucky that at this moment in time, as a mentor in the Artist Mother Crit program, I'm working with, you know, a group of wonderful other artists, my mentees, and they're really schooling and supporting me there in the moment. So it's a great exchange.
That's great. Go ahead, Amanda.
Yeah, I had something to add. So as far as wellness goes and just the sustainable life, I wanted to mention safety. And I know, Kaylin, you had a whole episode on studio safety. Mm-hmm. But even work with natural dyes, natural pigments, like wellness is part of that too. So wearing a dust mask or a respirator, mm-hmm. and it's also recommended to wear gloves, just kind of like taking care of yourself, even though these may, you know, be talked about as non-toxic potentially elements or materials. Mm-hmm. There are, you know, some trace amounts of toxins within a lot of our colors that we work with. So we just also just need to be careful and take care in that way as well.
Yeah, that's a great point, Amanda. Okay, one more question and then we'll wrap up with our final five. Just interested to hear both of you talk a little bit about any goals that you have coming up in the next year or 6 months. I know we're still kind of in the pandemic, but I think it's fun to just hear kind of what's cooking and what you're thinking about. Like, what are some things you want to move forward with in your career in the next, like I said, 6 months or a year or even further in the future, Danila?
Yeah, I have two primary goals, which I'd like to share in the spirit of sustainability. So the first one goes back to wellness, is I want to feel that I can sustain my practice by taking care of my physical wellness. And so the goal statement is I will commit to my autoimmune diet, get 8 hours of sleep, and walk and do yoga every day for the next 6 months.
Woo.
That's the first commitment and goal. And the second is I want to feel my value by being paid for my work so that I can sustain my artistic practice and dreams. And the goal statement is I bring in $10,000 in art sales by the end of 2021.
Mm, love that. Amanda, what about you? What are some future goals or things you're kind of working towards, have your eye on?
Well, as far as kind of going with Danila, as far as like sustainability goes, and just thinking about the land, the environment, I do need to do better at contacting government representatives, mm-hmm. and kind of speaking out a little bit more. I can kind of like do my own little thing here in my home, mm-hmm. and that is helpful, you know, and reducing meat consumption is helpful, but just kind of connecting with people in a broader sense, I mm-hmm. feel like that's something that I've not done very well. So that's kind of my goal in the next 6 months. And then personally, I don't have just a huge amount of art stuff going on for the rest of the year. Like I've not planned a whole lot, and mm-hmm. I don't know if that's intentional or if it's just coronavirus and everything's kind of in its own, you know, form here. But I'm excited about having quiet time, mm-hmm. and quiet time with my kids and being home with my kids and being slower. Mm-hmm. And last year I was kind of in the midst of getting ready for two fairly large art shows that just opened. And so I was kind of like jetting back and like, okay, Jason, you take the kids and I got to go do this project over here, and I got to go paint by the river for a little while, and I got to have 3 hours to do this, and just kind of like grabbing at any amount of time I could for my painting practice. And now that it's slowed down, I'm excited about having that quiet time with my kids. I'm also experimenting with paper making.
Nice.
And, you know, incorporating pigments into paper making. And so I'm just excited about like learning something new. Another thing is, I want to seek out gallery representation,
nice.
Especially in Nashville. And so that was like, you know, one of my like written down goals for many years, but I've just kind of put it off. And, I have a wonderful gallery that supports me in Atlanta, Spalding Mix Gallery, but just like my family lives in Nashville. And so that's just a more concrete goal that this is what I would like to do. And then of course, continuing to reach out to Indigenous keepers of the land and, think about collaboration with other artists. Always part of my piece. So.
Wonderful. Thank you both so much. This was so inspiring and informative. And I feel like I could hear you talk about this forever. So maybe we'll have to do a follow-up where we do a 2.0, like getting more advanced into some of the things. But I just want to thank you so much for doing the research and like being willing to commit, because I know it's not easy. I know it's like much easier to just let convenience and like the pressure to perform and produce really take over. And it's just really wonderful to have you in our community and to have you like more committed to that slowness, that more sustainable way of not only of making art, but also of living. So I really am inspired by that. So always like to close with a final 5 questions just for us to get to know you a little bit better. So want to hear, who is your biggest art crush? Daniela, you can start.
Okay. So, you know, this changes over time, but right now, like at this season, this point in my life, I'm currently really immersed in the work of and life of Eva Hesse.
Mm-hmm.
I was asked to give a talk about a woman artist at the Las Cruces Art Museum later this summer, and I've selected her. And as I continue to read and look at her work, really the thing that I'm very inspired by her work is the blurring of boundaries that she has in her work between drawing, painting, and sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
I'm particularly interested in her tenacity and her desire for independence and authenticity in her work, which she really discovered through her process with materials.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, I just really, you know, take away through, sadly, the loss of her, you know, her short career and her life, but her understanding that both art and life are short.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like I just really want to maximize the time I have to share with the world my passions and love for art making.
Amanda, what about you? Who's your biggest art crush right now?
right now, and for a long time, it's been Annie Albers.
Mm. She's like the predecessor to Eva. That's such an
interesting
combo.
Yes. I mean, she was such a wonderful teacher. And of course, she was in the Bauhaus, and she and her husband, Joseph, moved to Black Mountain College in North Carolina during World War II. And they taught there for many years and then moved, I think they ended up at Yale is what I want to say. But just reading her work and seeing her work, just how connected she is to material and how connected she is to the structure that each different kind of material lends to the overall work. You can read her writing and connect it to every way of making. And I love her work. I love her words. And yeah, she is my greatest art love. I could just talk about her forever.
Okay, what is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip you'd like to go on, Daniela?
So again, there's so many. I mean, for a long time, I wanted to go to Japan, and more recently also Oaxaca, Mexico, just to experience all the color in the land and the architecture and the textiles. But really, at this moment in time, my choice would be to go to Uruguay, South America, where I have family, my aunt and cousins live.
Mm-hmm.
My mother is in her 80s, and she made a wish to that the whole family could go over there next Christmas to be together, all together one last time, is what she said.
I hope that comes true for you. Amanda, what about you? Favorite place to travel or a dream trip?
Well, I guess favorite place to travel, my husband and I went on our honeymoon to Costa Rica, and we had our 10-year anniversary. We celebrated it there as well. Mm. And so it's just our dream to kind of go every, you know, maybe every 10 years. Mm. And I know, you know, flying is also not that sustainable thing to do as well. So we're spacing it out.
Yeah.
But yeah, so Costa Rica and, or just like really a dream trip would be a week-long backpacking trip with either my sisters. My older sister threw hike to the Appalachian Trail several years ago. So I don't know, just like being with my sisters and backpacking, I feel like I would love that. My little sister probably would not like that. But she'd have to come anyways, yep. Right? You know, like, that's just how it goes. Or my husband and kids, maybe when the boys get a little bit older.
Yeah, that sounds great. Okay, back to Danila. What film or book has inspired you greatly?
Okay, so I thought about this question for a while, and it really comes back to a book I read in college, which has been the most influential in my life, which is Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse. Mm-hmm. And it is the story, you know, basically of Siddhartha Gautama, which set me on my path over the last 25 years of studying, reading about Buddhism, and set me onto my path for meditation.
Mm. Amanda, what about you? Film or book that has inspired you greatly?
I'll say two books. One is, and both of these are fairly well known and today, Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson.
Yeah,
I read that 2 years ago, and I read it as I was taking a break from teaching art to incarcerated men in the Hamilton County Jail. And so before I read the book, when I was teaching art there, I was always like nervous and like kind of on guard and, you know, like I'm this pure person and you guys are criminals, you know,
mm-hmm.
kind of, you know. And then just after reading that book, I cried innumerable times, like in the midst of it. And after reading that book, just going back and being among these men in the jail and teaching, I'm going to have tears in my eyes right now.
Mm-hmm.
It just changed. It just changed my entire attitude toward these men and who they are and their humanity, you know? And so I just, yeah. But, you know, like one of the men, he came up to me after class and he said, Amanda, I just want to let you know that I murdered my 19-year-old son. And I just wanted to give him a hug. You know, just like I know in Bryan Stevenson's words, like you are not the worst thing that you have ever done.
Mm.
You know, and there's mental illness and there is drug abuse and addictions. And, you know, there are things that have happened to us. And so just goodness, that was a very much a life-changing book in the context of like being around these men, you know, and it's been very much a difficult year for them. And I'm not, you know, been able to teach or, you know, jails are closed right now. So, so we haven't been around them in about a year. Mm. So that's been a really important book. And then also Braiding Sweetgrass by Robin Wall Kimmerer. I read that a couple years ago as well. And just like, oh,
so
just
good.
Ideas of the, and you guys did it as a reading club?
We did it. We did it at our in-person retreat, which was in outside of Nashville in 2019. We had kind of invited everyone to read two books before the retreat, and then we talked about them as like in part of the retreat programming. And Braiding Sweetgrass, oh my gosh, definitely like one of the most influential books for sure. It's so beautiful.
And the idea of the honorable harvest, you know, just taking those ideas, okay, this is what always is going to be in my heart as I enter into these lands and, you know, look for color. So very important.
Yeah, that was a huge takeaway for me too. And another book that was on my list, if I had to put it there.
Yeah. I, as we were talking, like I was thinking about that book several different times, just in terms of like some of the things you all brought up, and I was like, I hope they've read Braiding Sweetgrass, but I assumed that you had. Okay, back to Danila. What's your favorite meal?
Okay, this season of time, it would be a sushi date night with my husband.
sushi in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Is it
good? I know. That's existed it for so long because really that memory is more of a longing from our days on the West Coast.
Yeah.
And I didn't until this year decide I'm just going to go for it. But, you know, not the most sustainable, but they probably obviously fly the fish in. And so once in a while, and there's a rare date.
It's a good treat, yeah. And you could always just make it more veggie heavy. Like, I mean, veggie sushi is amazing, and that can be great anywhere. So, Amanda, what about you? Favorite meal?
I just love food. But so I guess recently I've made a vegan potato white bean soup.
Mm.
And it has like coconut milk in it. And that with a fresh baguette, just so good.
Mm.
It is filling and it is wonderful. But if I'm going to choose like a really big treat meal,
mm-hmm.
it's going to be salmon with risotto and maybe some asparagus on the side.
Y'all are making me hungry. Okay, finally, in the spirit of community, I always like to offer, you know, a space for you to give a shout out to someone who supports you in your work. So, Danila, who do you want to give a shout out to?
Okay, I'd like to give a shout out to both of my parents. And since they're both still here with us, I'd like to say it in first person to them. So, Dad, thanks for always being there for me and asking me questions that have helped me clarify what my next steps in life would be, such as the time when you asked me what I would be doing between high school and college, and when I didn't know, you signed me up for a painting course at Northwestern.
Mm.
To the time in college when I declared a painting major, and you asked me if I would consider a design major, and I said no, and you said okay. To the most recent time, when I went through reckoning unrealized dreams, you asked me, is there any other life than an art life? And you encouraged me to go on.
Hmm.
So the support from my dad has always been equal with my mother's. So, Mom, you have been my greatest role model in your courage to leave your home country, Colombia, where you felt opportunity was limited, and move to the States in order to pursue your PhD. Your life has always inspired me to take risks into the unknown and go for what fills me with passion. To go on, your tenacity in pursuing a full-time job as a professor while raising your two children showed me how to believe in myself and persist through all the adversity and appreciate what I have. Thank you.
Beautiful, Danila. Thank you so much. Amanda, what about you? Who do you want to give a shout out to who supported you in your work?
Definitely my parents have been super supportive. Like Danila said, when I wanted to be an art major, they're like, okay. And yeah, they've been wonderful. And my husband, of course, Jason, especially this past year when our schedules, you know, everyone's schedules have just been crazy. He has always stepped up and said, okay, Amanda, what do you need? What do you need this week? What do you need today? I'm here for this amount of time. You know, you go do something. And so he's been very, very supportive. And I'll cry again. Good night. Sometimes I just let it out here. My sons, honestly, they affirm me every single night. And they tell me, we have this nightly tradition of, I love you and I like you and I think you're so awesome. And my older son, Judah, goes, and I think you're the best rock smasher and you're the best pigment sifter and you're the best paint maker and you're the best artist.
Mm.
And so he goes through and just the sweetest. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's just such an honor to be their mom, which I know that's kind of sappy, but it's just wonderful. They're awesome kids. And of course, you know, the rest of my family, my three sisters and especially my aunt. And then also Sandy Webster, who was the first one who I kind of entered into her teaching and I'm still connected with her today. And I really appreciate the generosity with which she shared her knowledge and the beauty of the work that she creates.
Thank you both so much. What a thoughtful and inspiring interview. Like I already said, just really appreciate this. Okay. Last thing, where can people find you? What's your Instagram and website, Danila?
Okay, so DanilaRumold.com is the website. And then my name again, Danila.Rumold on Instagram.
Amanda, what about you?
Mine is AmandaBrazier.com. And then my Instagram is AB.Brazier.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much. We'll have to think of some other ways for both of you to share your knowledge and wisdom with the community, maybe some workshops or something in the future, but just appreciate this. And yeah, just thank you so much for your commitment and dedication and just for the way you live out your values so thoughtfully. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kaylin.
Yeah, thank you. It's been wonderful talking with you both.
The Artist Mother podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.